Never again will we be associated with anything as gigantic and full of meaning as this particular program. Here is a glimpse of the car which will be before the American public on September 4, 1957. At this point, Judge would show a provocative slide of a hubcap or section of fender. It is a different car in every respect, yet it has an element of conservatism which will give it maximum appeal. The distinctiveness of the frontal styling integrates with the sculptured patterns of the side treatment. And on, Judge would rhapsodize, rolling out such awesome phrases as sculptured sheet metal, highlight character, and graceful flowing lines. At last would come the ringing peroration. "We are proud of the Edsel," he would cry, kicking switches right and left. "When it is introduced this fall, it will take its place on the streets and highways of America, bringing new greatness to the Ford Motor Company. This is the Edsel story." The drum roll climax of the striptease was a 3-day press preview of the Edsel, undraped from pinched-in snout to flaring rear, that was held in Detroit and Dearborn on August 26th, 27th, and 28th, with 250 reporters from all over the country in attendance. It differed from previous automotive jamborees of its kind in that the journalists were invited to bring their wives along, and many of them did. Before it was over, it had cost the Ford Company $90,000. Grand as it was, the conventionality of its setting was a disappointment to Warnock, who had proposed, and seen rejected, three locales that he thought would provide a more offbeat ambiance. A steamer on the Detroit River. Wrong symbolism. Edsel, Kentucky. Inaccessible by road. And Haiti. Just turned down flat. Thus hobbled, Warnock could do no better for the reporters and their wives when they converged on the Detroit scene on Sunday evening, August 25th, than to put them up at the discouragingly named Sheraton Cadillac Hotel, and to arrange for them to spend Monday afternoon hearing and reading about the long-awaited details of the entire crop of Edsels, 18 varieties available in 4 main lines, Corsair, Citation, Pacer, and Ranger, differing mainly in their size, power, and trim. The next morning, specimens of the models themselves were revealed to the reporters in the Styling Center's rotunda, and Henry II offered a few words of tribute to his father. The wives were not asked to the unveiling. A foot-cone man who helped plan the affair recalls, "It was too solemn and businesslike an event for that. It went over fine. There was excitement even among the hardened newspapermen." The import of the stories that most of the excited newspapermen filed was that the Edsel seemed to be a good car, though not so radical as its billing had suggested. In the afternoon, the reporters were whisked out to the test track to see a team of stunt drivers put the Edsel through its paces. This event, calculated to be thrilling, turned out to be hair-raising, and even for some a little unstringing. Enjoined not to talk too much about speed and horsepower, since only a few months previously, the whole automobile industry had nobly resolved to concentrate on making cars instead of delayed-action bombs, Warnock had decided to emphasize the Edsel's liveliness through deeds rather than words, and to accomplish this, he had hired a team of stunt drivers. Edsels ran over 2-foot ramps on 2 wheels, bounced from higher ramps on all 4 wheels, were driven in crisscross patterns, grazing each other at 60 or 70 miles per hour, and skidded into complete turns at 50. For comic relief, there was a clown driver parodying the daredevil stuff. All the while, the voice of Neil L. Bloom, Edsel's engineering chief, could be heard on a loudspeaker purring about the capabilities, the safety, the ruggedness, the maneuverability and performance of these new cars, and skirting the words speed and horsepower as delicately as a sandpiper skirts a wave. At one point, when an Edsel leaping a high ramp just missed turning over, Crafty's face took on a ghastly pallor. He later reported that he had not known that daredevil stunts were going to be so extreme, and was concerned both for the good name of the Edsel and the lives of the drivers. Warnock, noticing his boss's distress, went over and asked Crafty if he was enjoying the show. Crafty replied tersely that he would answer when it was over and all hands safe. But everyone else seemed to be having a grand time. The foot cone man said, "He looked over this green Michigan hill, and there were those glorious Edsels, performing gloriously in unison. It was beautiful. It was like the Rockettes. It was exciting. Morale was high." Warnock's high spirits had carried him to even wilder extremes of fancy. The stunt driving, like the unveiling, was considered too rich for the blood of the wives, but the resourceful Warnock was ready for them with a fashion show that he hoped they would find at least equally diverting. He need not have worried. The star of the show, who was introduced by Brown, the Edsel stylist, as a Paris couturier, both beautiful and talented, turned out at the final curtain to be a female impersonator, a fact of which Warnock, to heighten the verisimilitude of the act, had given Brown no advance warning. Things were never again quite the same between Brown and Warnock, but the wives were able to give their husbands an extra paragraph or two for their stories. That evening there was a big gala for one and all at the Styling Center, which was itself styled as a nightclub for the occasion, complete with a fountain that danced in time with the music of Ray McKinley's band, whose emblem, the letters GM, a holdover from the days of its founder, the late Glenn Miller, was emblazoned, as usual, on the music stand of each musician, very nearly ruining the evening for Warnock. The next morning, at a wind-up press conference held by Ford officials, Breach declared of the Edsel, "It's a husky, youngster, and like most other new parents, we're proud enough to pop our buttons." Then 71 of the reporters took the wheels of as many Edsels and set out for home, not to drive the cars into their garages, but to deliver them to the showrooms of their local Edsel dealers. Let Warnock describe the highlights of this final flourish. "There were several unfortunate occurrences. One guy simply miscalculated and cracked up his car running into something. No fault of the Edsel there. One car lost its oil pan, so naturally the motor froze. It can happen to the best of cars. Fortunately, at the time of this malfunction, the driver was going through a beautiful-sounding town, Paradise, Kansas, I think it was, and that gave the news reports about it a nice little positive touch. The nearest dealer gave the reporter a new Edsel, and he drove on home, climbing Pike's Peak on the way. Then one car crashed through a toll gate when the brakes failed. That was bad. It's funny, but the thing we were most worried about, other drivers being so eager to get a look at the Edsels that they'd crowd our cars off the road, happened only once. That was on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. One of our reporters was tooling along, no problems, when a Plymouth driver pulled up alongside to rubberneck and edged so close that the Edsel got sideswiped. Minor damage. Late in 1959, immediately after the demise of the Edsel, Business Week stated that at the big press preview, a Ford executive had said to a reporter, "If the company weren't in so deep, we never would have brought it out now." However, since Business Week neglected to publish this patently sensational statement for over 2 years, and since to this day all the former ranking Edsel executives, Crafty included, notwithstanding his preoccupation with the luckless dog food company, firmly maintained that right up to Edsel Day, and even for a short time thereafter, they expected the Edsel to succeed. It would seem that the quotation should be regarded as a highly suspect archaeological find. Indeed, during the period between the press preview and Edsel Day, the spirit of everybody associated with the venture seems to have been one of wild optimism. "Oldsmobile, goodbye," ran the headline on an ad in the Detroit Free Press, for an agency that was switching from Olds to Edsel. A dealer in Portland, Oregon, reported that he had already sold two Edsels sight unseen. Warnock dug up a fireworks company in Japan, willing to make him, at $9 apiece, 5,000 rockets that, exploding in midair, would release 9-foot scale model Edsels made of rice paper that would inflate and descend like parachutes, his head reeling with visions of filling America's skies as well as its highways with Edsels on Edsel Day. Warnock was about to dash off an order when Crafty, looking something more than puzzled, shook his head. On September 3rd, E-Day minus one, the prices of the various Edsel models were announced. For cars delivered to New York, they ran from just under $2,800 to just over $4,100. On E-Day, the Edsel arrived. In Cambridge, a band led a gleaming motorcade of the new cars up Massachusetts Avenue. Flying out of Richmond, California, a helicopter, hired by one of the most jubilant of the dealers, lassoed by Doyle, spread a giant Edsel sign above San Francisco Bay. And all over the nation, from the Louisiana bayous to the peak of Mount Rainier to the Maine woods, one needed only a radio or a television set to know that the very air, despite Warnock's setback on the rockets, was quivering with the presence of the Edsel. The tone for Edsel Day's blizzard of publicity was set by an ad, published in newspapers all over the country, in which the Edsel shared the spotlight with the Ford Company's President Ford and Chairman Breech. In the ad, Ford looked like a dignified young father, Breech like a dignified gentleman, holding a full house against a possible strait. The Edsel just looked like an Edsel. The accompanying text declared that the decision to produce the car had been based on what we knew, guessed, felt, believed, suspected about you, and added, "You are the reason behind the Edsel." The tone was calm and confident. There did not seem to be much room for doubt about the reality of that full house. Before sundown, it was estimated 2,850,000 people had seen the new car in dealer showrooms. 3 days later, in North Philadelphia, an Edsel was stolen. It can reasonably be argued that the crime marked the high-water mark of public acceptance of the Edsel. Only a few months later, any but the least fastidious of car thieves might not have bothered. Decline and fall. The most striking physical characteristic of the Edsel was, of course, its radiator grille. This in contrast to the wide and horizontal grills of all 19 other American makes of the time, was slender and vertical. Of chromium-plated steel, and shaped something like an egg, it sat in the middle of the car's front end, and was embellished by the word Edsel in aluminum letters running down its length. It was intended to suggest the front end of practically any car of 20 or 30 years ago, and of most contemporary European cars, and thus to look at once seasoned and sophisticated. The trouble was that whereas the front ends of the antiques and the European cars were themselves high and narrow, consisting, indeed, of little more than the radiator grills, the front end of the Edsel was broad and low, just like the front ends of all its American competitors. Consequently, there were wide areas on either side of the grill that had to be filled in with something. And filled in they were, with twin panels of entirely conventional horizontal chrome grillwork. The effect was that of an Oldsmobile with the prow of a Pierce Arrow implanted in its front end, or, more metaphorically, of the charwoman trying on the Duchess necklace. The attempt at sophistication was so transparent as to be endearing. But if the grill of the Edsel appealed through guilelessness, the rear end was another matter. Here, too, there was a marked departure from the conventional design of the day. Instead of the notorious tail fin, the car had what looked to its fanciers like wings, and to others, less ethereal-minded, like eyebrows. The lines of the trunk lid and the rear fenders, swooping upward and outward, did somewhat resemble the wings of a gull in flight, but the resemblance was marred by two long, narrow taillights, set partly in the trunk lid and partly in the fenders, which followed those lines and created the startling illusion, especially at night, of a slant-eyed grin. From the front, the Edsel seemed, above all, anxious to please, even at the cost of being clownish. From the rear, it looked crafty, oriental, smug, one-up, maybe a little cynical and contemptuous, too. It was as if, Somewhere between grill and rear fenders, a sinister personality change had taken place. In other respects, the exterior styling of the Edsel was not far out of the ordinary. Its sides were festooned with a bit less than the average amount of chrome, and distinguished by a gouged-out bullet-shaped groove extending forward from the rear fender for about half the length of the car. Midway along this groove, the word Edsel was displayed in chrome letters, and just below the rear window was a small grill-like decoration, on which was spelled out, of all things, Edsel. After all, hadn't Stylus Brown declared his intention to create a vehicle that would be readily recognizable? In its interior, the Edsel strove mightily to live up to the prediction of General Manager Craffy that the car would be the epitome of the push-button era. The push-button era in medium-priced cars, being what it was, Craffy's had been a rash prophecy indeed. But the Edsel rose to it, with a devilish assemblage of gadgets such as had seldom, if ever, been seen before. On or near the Edsel's dashboard were a push-button that popped the trunk lid open, a lever that popped the hood open, a lever that released the parking brake, a speedometer that glowed red when the driver exceeded his chosen maximum speed, a single dial control for both heating and cooling, a tachometer in the best racing car style, buttons to operate or regulate the lights, the height of the radio antenna, the heater blower, the windshield wiper, and the cigarette lighter, and a row of 8 red lights to wink warnings that the engine was too hot, that it wasn't hot enough, that the generator was on the blink, that the parking brake was on, that a door was open, that the oil pressure was low, that the oil level was low, and that the gasoline level was low, the last of which the skeptical driver could confirm by consulting the gas gauge, mounted a few inches away. Epitomizing this epitome, the automatic transmission control box, arrestingly situated on top of the steering post in the center of the wheel, sprouted a galaxy of 5 push-buttons so light to the touch that, as Edsel men could hardly be restrained from demonstrating, they could be depressed with a toothpick. Of the 4 lines of Edsels, both of the 2 larger and more expensive ones, the Corsair and the Citation, were 219 inches long, or 2 inches longer than the biggest of the Oldsmobiles. Both were 80 inches wide, or about as wide as passenger cars ever get, and the height of both was only 57 inches, as low as any other medium-priced car. The Ranger and the Pacer, the smaller Edsels, were 6 inches shorter, an inch narrower, and an inch lower than the Corsair and the Citation. The Corsair and the Citation were equipped with 345 horsepower engines, making them more powerful than any other American car at the time of their debut. And the Ranger and the Pacer were good for 303 horsepower, near the top in their class. At the touch of a toothpick to the drive button, an idling Corsair or Citation sedan, more than 2 tons of car in either case, could, if properly skippered, take off with such abruptness that in 10 3/10 seconds it would be doing a mile a minute, and in 17 1/2 seconds it would be a quarter of a mile down the road. If anything, or anybody, happened to be in the way when the toothpick touched the push button, so much the worse. When the wraps were taken off the Edsel, it received what is known in the theatrical business as a mixed press. The automotive editors of the daily newspapers stuck mostly to straight descriptions of the car, with only here and there a phrase or two of appraisal, some of it ambiguous. "The difference in style is spectacular," noted Joseph C. Ingraham in the New York Times, "and some of it openly favorable. A handsome and hard-punching newcomer," said Fred Olmsted in the Detroit Free Press. Magazine criticism was generally more exhaustive and occasionally more severe. Motor Trend, the largest monthly devoted to ordinary automobiles, as distinct from hot rods, devoted 8 pages of its October 1957 issue to an analysis and critique of the Edsel by Joe H. Weary, its Detroit editor. Weary liked the car's appearance, its interior comfort, and its gadgets, although he did not always make it clear just why. In paying his respects to the transmission buttons on the steering post, he wrote, "You need not take your eyes off the road for an instant." He conceded that there were untold opportunities for more unique approaches, but he summed up his opinion in a sentence that fairly peppered the Edsel with honorific adverbs. "The Edsel performs fine, rides well, and handles good." Tom McCahill of Mechanics Illustrated generally admired the bolt bag, as he affectionately called the Edsel, but he had some reservations, which, incidentally, throw some interesting light on an automobile critic's equivalent of an aisle seat. "On ribbed concrete," he reported, "every time I shot the throttle to the floor quickly, the wheels spun like a gone wild wearing blender. At high speeds, especially through rough corners, I found the suspension a little too horsebacky. I couldn't help but wonder what this salami would really do if it had enough road adhesion." By far the most downright, and very likely the most damaging, panning that the Edsel got during its first months appeared in the January 1958 issue of the Consumers Union Monthly, Consumer Reports, whose 800,000 subscribers probably included more potential Edsel buyers than if ever turned the pages of Motor Trend or Mechanics Illustrated. After having put a Corsair through a series of road tests, Consumer Reports declared, "The Edsel has no important basic advantages over other brands. The car is almost entirely conventional in construction. The amount of shake present in this Corsair body on rough roads, which wasn't long in making itself heard as squeaks and rattles, went well beyond any acceptable limit. The Corsair's handling qualities, sluggish, overslow steering, sway and lean on turns, and a general detached from the road feel, are, to put it mildly, without distinction. As a matter of simple fact, combined with the car's tendency to shake like jelly, Edsel handling represents retrogression rather than progress. Stepping on the gas in traffic, or in passing cars, or just to feel the pleasurable surge of power, will cause those big cylinders really to lap up fuel. The center of the steering wheel is not, in CU's opinion, a good push-button location. To look at the Edsel buttons pulls the driver's eyes clear down off the road. Pace, Mr. Weary. The luxury-loaded Edsel, as one magazine cover described it, will certainly please anyone who confuses gadgetry with true luxury. 3 months later, in a roundup of all the 1958 model cars, Consumer Reports went at the Edsel again, calling it more uselessly overpowered, more gadget-bedecked, more hung with expensive accessories than any car in its price class, and giving the Corsair and the Citation the bottom position in its competitive ratings. Like Crafty, Consumer Reports considered the Edsel an epitome. Unlike Crafty, the magazine concluded that the car seemed to epitomize the many excesses with which Detroit manufacturers were repulsing more and more potential car buyers. And yet, in a way, the Edsel wasn't so bad. It embodied much of the spirit of its time, or at least of the time when it was designed, early in 1955. It was clumsy, powerful, dowdy, gauche, well-meaning, a de Kooning woman. Few people, apart from employees of Foot, Cone, and Belding, who were paid to do so, have adequately hymned its ability, at its best, to coax and jolly the harried owner into a sense of well-being. Furthermore, the designers of several rival makes, including Chevrolet, Buick, and Ford, Edsel's own stablemate, later flattered Brown's styling by imitating at least one feature of the car's much-reviled lines, the rear-end wing theme. The Edsel was obviously jinxed, but to say that it was jinxed by its design alone would be an oversimplification, as it would be to say that it was jinxed by an excess of motivational research. The fact is that in the short, unhappy life of the Edsel, a number of other factors contributed to its commercial downfall. One of these was the scarcely believable circumstance that many of the very first Edsels, those obviously destined for the most glaring public limelight, were dramatically imperfect. By its preliminary program of promotion and advertising, the Ford Company had built up an overwhelming head of public interest in the Edsel, causing its arrival to be anticipated and the car itself to be gawked at with more eagerness than had ever greeted any automobile before it. After all that, it seemed, the car didn't quite work. Within a few weeks after the Edsel was introduced, its pratfalls were the talk of the land. Edsels were delivered with oil leaks, sticking hoods, trunks that wouldn't open, and push buttons that, far from yielding to a toothpick, couldn't be budged with a hammer. An obviously distraught man staggered into a bar up the Hudson River, demanding a double shot without delay, and exclaiming that the dashboard of his new Edsel had just burst into flame. Automotive News reported that in general the earliest Edsels suffered from poor paint, inferior sheet metal, and faulty accessories, and quoted the lament of a dealer about one of the first Edsel convertibles he received. The top was badly set, doors cockeyed, the header bar trimmed at the wrong angle, and the front springs sagged. The Ford Company had the particular bad luck to sell to Consumers Union, which buys its test cars in the open market as a precaution against being favored with specially doctored samples, an Edsel in which the axle ratio was wrong, an expansion plug in the cooling system blew out, the power steering pump leaked, the rear axle gears were noisy, and the heater emitted blasts of hot air when it was turned off. A former executive of the Edsel division has estimated that only about half of the first Edsels really performed properly. A layman cannot help wondering how the Ford Company, in all its power and glory, could have been guilty of such a Mack Sennett routine of build-up and anticlimax. The one hard-working Crafty explains gamely that when a company brings out a new model of any make, even an old and tested one, the first cars often have bugs in them. A more startling theory, though only a theory, is that there may have been sabotage in some of the four plants that assembled the Edsel, all but one of which had previously been, and currently also were, assembling Fords or Mercurys. In marketing the Edsel, the Ford Company took a leaf out of the book of General Motors, which for years had successfully been permitting and even encouraging the makers and sellers of its Oldsmobiles, Buicks, Pontiacs, and the higher-priced models of its Chevrolet to fight for customers with no quarter given. Faced with the same sort of intramural competition, some members of the Ford and Lincoln Mercury divisions of the Ford Company openly hoped from the start for the Edsel's downfall. Crafty, realizing what might happen, had asked that the Edsel be assembled in plants of its own, but his superiors turned him down. However, Doyle, speaking with the authority of a veteran of the automobile business, as well as with that of Crafty's second-in-command, pooh-poohs the notion that the Edsel was a victim of dirty work at the plants. Of course, the Ford and Lincoln Mercury divisions didn't want to see another Ford Company car in the field, he says, but as far as I know, anything they did at the executive and plant level was in competitive good taste. On the other hand, at the distribution and dealer level, you got some rough infighting in terms of whispering and propaganda. If I'd been in one of the other divisions, I'd have done the same thing. No proud, defeated general of the old school ever spoke more nobly. It is a tribute of sorts to the men who gave the Edsel its big build-up that although cars tending to rattle, balk, and fall apart into shiny heaps of junk kept coming off the assembly lines, things didn't go badly at first. Doyle says that on Edsel Day, more than 6,500 Edsels were either ordered by or actually delivered to customers. That was a good showing. But there are isolated signs of resistance. For instance, a New England dealer selling Edsels in one showroom and Buicks in another reported that two prospects walked into the Edsel showroom, took a look at the Edsel, and placed orders for Buicks on the spot. In the next few days, sales dropped sharply. But that was to be expected once the bloom was off. Automobile deliveries to dealers, one of the important indicators in the trade, are customarily measured in 10-day periods. And during the first 10 days of September, on only six of which the Edsel was on sale, it racked up 4,095. This was lower than Doyle's first-day figure because many of the initial purchases were of models and color combinations not in stock, which had to be factory-assembled to order. The delivery total for the second 10-day period was off slightly, and that for the third was down to just under 3,600. For the first 10 days of October, nine of which were business days, there were only 2,751 deliveries, an average of just over 300 cars a day. In order to sell the 200,000 cars per year that would make the Edsel operation profitable, the Ford company would have to move an average of between 600 and 700 each business day, a good many more than 300 a day. On the night of Sunday, October 13th, Ford put on a mammoth television spectacular for Edsel, preempting the time ordinarily allotted to the Ed Sullivan Show. But though the program cost $400,000 and starred Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra, it failed to cause any sharp spurt in sales. Now it was obvious that things were not going at all well. Among the former executives of the Edsel division, opinions differ as to the exact moment when the portents of doom became unmistakable. Crafty feels that the moment did not arrive until sometime late in October. Wallace, in his capacity as Edsel's pipe-smoking semi-brain truster, goes a step further by pinning the start of the disaster to a specific date, October 4th, the day the first Soviet Sputnik went into orbit, shattering the myth of American technical preeminence and precipitating a public revulsion against Detroit's fancier baubles. Public Relations Director Warnock maintains that his barometric sensitivity to the public temper enabled him to call the turn as early as mid-September. Contrarywise, Doyle says he maintained his optimism until mid-November, by which time he was about the only man in the division who had not concluded it would take a miracle to save the Edsel. In November, says Wallace, sociologically, there was panic, and its concomitant mob action. The mob action took the form of a concerted tendency to blame the design of the car for the whole debacle. Edsel men who had previously had nothing but lavish praise for the radiator grille and rear end now went around muttering that any fool could see they were ludicrous. The obvious sacrificial victim was Brown, whose stock had gone through the roof at the time of the regally accoladed debut of his design, in August 1955. Now, without having done anything further, for either better or worse, the poor fellow became the company scapegoat. Beginning in November, nobody talked to Roy, Wallace says. On November 27th, as if things weren't bad enough, Charles Chrysler, who was the only Edsel dealer in Manhattan, provided its prize showcase, announced that he was turning in his franchise because of poor sales, and it was rumored that he added, "The Ford Motor Company has laid an egg." He thereupon signed up with American Motors to sell its Rambler, which, as the only domestic small car then on the market, was already the possessor of a zooming sales curve. Doyle grimly commented that the Edsel division was not concerned about Chrysler's defection. By December, the panic at Edsel had abated to the point where its sponsors could pull themselves together and begin casting about for ways to get sales moving again. Henry Ford II, manifesting himself to Edsel dealers on closed-circuit television, urged them to remain calm, promised that the company would back them to the limit, and said flatly, "The Edsel is here to stay." 1.5 million letters went out over Crafty's signature to owners of medium-priced cars, asking them to drop around at their local dealers and test-ride the Edsel. Everyone doing so, Crafty promised, would be given an 8-inch plastic scale model of the car, whether he bought a full-size one or not. The Edsel division picked up the check for the scale models. A symptom of desperation, indeed. For under normal circumstances, no automobile manufacturer would make even a move to outfumble its dealers for such a tab. Up to that time, the dealers had paid for everything, as is customary. The division also began offering its dealers what it called sales bonuses, which meant that the dealers could knock anything from $100 to $300 off the price of each car without reducing their profit margin. Crafty told a reporter that sales up to then were about what he had expected them to be, although not what he had hoped they would be. In his zeal, not to seem unpleasantly surprised, he appeared to be saying that he had expected the Edsel to fail. The Edsel's advertising campaign, which had started with studied dignity, began to sound a note of stridency. "Everyone who has seen it knows, with us, that the Edsel is a success," a magazine ad declared, and in a later ad, this phrase was twice repeated, like an incantation. "The Edsel is a success. It is a new idea, a U idea, on the American road. The Edsel is a success." Soon the even less high-toned but more dependable advertising themes of price and social status began to intrude, in such sentences as, "They'll know you've arrived when you drive up in an Edsel," and, "The one that's really new is the lowest priced, too." In the more rarefied sectors of Madison Avenue, a resort to rhymed slogans is usually regarded as an indication of artistic depravity induced by commercial necessity. From the frantic and costly measures the Edsel division took in December, it garnered one tiny crumb. For the first 10-day period of 1958, it was able to report sales were up 18.6% over those of the last 10 days of 1957. The catch, as the Wall Street Journal alertly noted, was that the latter period embraced one more selling day than the earlier one, so for practical purposes, there had scarcely been a gain at all. In any case, that early January word of meretricious cheer turned out to be the Edsel division's last gesture. On January 14, 1958, the Ford Motor Company announced that it was consolidating the Edsel division with the Lincoln Mercury division to form a Mercury Edsel Lincoln division under the management of James J. Nance, who had been running Lincoln Mercury. It was the first time that one of the major automobile companies had lumped three divisions into one since General Motors' merger of Buick, Oldsmobile, and Pontiac back in the Depression, and to the people of the expunged Edsel division, the meaning of the administrative move was all too clear. With that much competition in a division, the Edsel wasn't going anywhere, Doyle says. It became a stepchild. For the last year and 10 months of its existence, the Edsel was very much a stepchild. Generally neglected, little advertised, and kept alive only to avoid publicizing a boner any more than necessary, and in the forlorn hope that it might go somewhere after all. What advertising it did get strove quixotically to assure the automobile trade that everything was dandy. In mid-February, an ad in Automotive News had Nance saying, "Since the formation of the new MEL division at Ford Motor Company, we have analyzed with keen interest the sales progress of the Edsel. We think it is quite significant that during the 5 months since the Edsel was introduced, Edsel sales have been greater than the first 5 month sales for any other new make of car ever introduced on the American road. Edsel's steady progress can be a source of satisfaction and a great incentive to all of us." Nance's comparison, however, was almost meaningless. No new make ever having been introduced anything like so grandiosely, and the note of confidence could not help ringing hollow. It is quite possible that Nance's attention was never called to an article by S.I. Hayakawa, the semanticist, that was published in the spring of 1958 in ETC, A Review of General Semantics, a quarterly magazine under the title Why the Edsel Laid an Egg. Hayakawa, who was both the founder and the editor of ETC, explained in an introductory note that he considered the subject within the purview of general semantics because automobiles, like words, are important symbols in American culture. And went on to argue that the Edsel's flop could be attributed to Ford company executives who had been listening too long to the motivation research people, and who, in their efforts to turn out a car that would satisfy customers' sexual fantasies and the like, had failed to supply reasonable and practical transportation, thereby neglecting the reality principle. What the motivation researchers failed to tell their clients is that only the psychotic and the gravely neurotic act out their irrationalities in their compensatory fantasies, Hayakawa admonished Detroit briskly and added, the trouble with selling symbolic gratification via such expensive items as the Edsel hermaphrodite is the competition offered by much cheaper forms of symbolic gratification, such as Playboy, 50 cents a copy, astounding science fiction, 35 cents a copy, and television, free. Notwithstanding the competition from Playboy, or possibly because the symbol-motivated public included people who could afford both, the Edsel kept rolling, but just barely. The car moved, as salesmen say, though hardly at the touch of a toothpick. In fact, as a stepchild, it sold about as well as it had sold as a favorite son, suggesting that all the hoopla, whether about symbolic gratification or mere horsepower, had little effect one way or the other. The new Edsels that were registered with the motor vehicle bureaus of the various states during 1958 numbered 34,481, considerably fewer than new cars of any competing make, and less than one-fifth of the 200,000 a year necessary if the Edsel was to show a profit, but still representing an investment by motorists of over $100 million. The picture actually brightened in November 1958, with the advent of the Edsel's second-year models. Shorter by up to 8 inches, lighter by up to 500 pounds, and with engines less potent by as much as 158 horsepower, they had a price range running from $500 to $800 less than that of their predecessors. The vertical grille and the slant-eyed rear end were still there, but the modest power and proportions persuaded Consumer Reports to relent and say, the Ford Motor Company, after giving last year's initial Edsel model a black eye, has made a respectable and even likable automobile of it. Quite a number of motorists seemed to agree. About 2,000 more Edsels were sold in the first half of 1959 than had been sold in the first half of 1958. And by the early summer of 1959, the car was moving at the rate of around 4,000 a month. Here at last was progress. Sales were at almost a quarter of the minimum profitable rate, instead of a mere fifth. On July 1, 1959, there were 83,849 Edsels on the country's roads. The largest number, 8,344, were in California, which is perennially beset with far and away the largest number of cars of practically all makes, and the smallest number were in Alaska, Vermont, and Hawaii, 122, 119, and 110, respectively. All in all, the Edsel seemed to have found a niche for itself as an amusingly eccentric curiosity. Although the Ford Company, with its stockholders' money still disappearing week after week into the Edsel, and with small cars now clearly the order of the day, could scarcely affect a sentimental approach to the subject, it nonetheless took an outside chance, and in mid-October of 1959, brought out a third series of annual models. The 1960 Edsel appeared a little more than a month after the Falcon, Ford's first and instantly successful venture into the small car field, and was scarcely an Edsel at all. Gone were both the vertical grille and the horizontal rear end, and what remained looked like a cross between a Ford Fairlane and a Pontiac. Its initial sales were abysmal. By the middle of November, only one plant, in Louisville, Kentucky, was still turning out Edsels, and it was turning out only about 20 a day. On November 19th, the Ford Foundation, which was planning to sell a block of its vast holdings of stock in the Ford Motor Company, issued the prospectus that is required by law under such circumstances, and stated therein, in a footnote to a section describing the company's products, that the Edsel had been introduced in September 1957 and discontinued in November 1959. The same day, this mumbled admission was confirmed and amplified by a Ford company spokesman, who did some mumbling of his own. "If we knew the reason people aren't buying the Edsel, we'd probably have done something about it," he said. The final quantitative box score shows that from the beginning, right up to November 19th, 110,810 Edsels were produced, and 109,466 were sold. The remaining 1,344, almost all of them 1960 models, were disposed of in short order with the help of drastic price cuts. All told, only 2,846 of the 1960 Edsels were ever produced, making models of that year a potential collector's item. To be sure, it will be generations before 1960 Edsels are as scarce as the Type 41 Bugatti, of which no more than 11 specimens were made back in the late 20s, to be sold only to bona fide kings. And the 1960 Edsel's reasons for being a rarity are not exactly as acceptable, socially or commercially, as the Type 41 Bugattis. Still, a 1960 Edsel Owners Club may yet appear. The final fiscal box score on the Edsel fiasco will probably never be known, because the Ford Motor Company's public reports do not include breakdowns of gains and losses within the individual divisions. Financial buffs estimate, however, that the company lost something like $200 million on the Edsel after it appeared. Add to this the officially announced expenditure of $250 million before it appeared. Subtract about $100 million invested in plant and equipment that were salvageable for other uses, and the net loss is $350 million. If these estimates are right, every Edsel the company manufactured cost it in lost money about $3,200, or about the price of another one. In other, harsher words, the company would have saved itself money if, back in 1955, it had decided not to produce the Edsel at all, but simply to give away 110,810 specimens of its comparably priced car, the Mercury. The end of the Edsel set off an orgy of hindsight in the press. Time declared, the Edsel was a classic case of the wrong car for the wrong market at the wrong time. It was also a prime example of the limitations of market research, with its depth interviews and motivational mumbo-jumbo. Business Week, which shortly before the Edsel made its bow, had described it with patent solemnity and apparent approval, now pronounced it a nightmare, and appended a few pointedly critical remarks about Wallace's research, which was rapidly achieving a scapegoat status equal to that of Brown's design. Jumping up and down on motivational research was, and is, splendid sport. But of course, the implication that it dictated, or even influenced, the Edsel's design is entirely false, since the research, being intended only to provide a theme for advertising and promotion, was not undertaken until after Brown had completed his design. The Wall Street Journal's obituary of the Edsel made a point that was probably sounder and certainly more original. Large corporations are often accused of rigging markets, administering prices, and otherwise dictating to the consumer, it observed. And yesterday, Ford Motor Company announced its 2-year experiment with the medium-priced Edsel has come to an end, for want of buyers. All this is quite a ways from automakers being able to rig markets or force consumers to take what they want them to take. And the reason, simply, is that there is no accounting for tastes. When it comes to dictating, the consumer is the dictator without peer. The tone of the piece was friendly and sympathetic. The Ford company, it seemed, had endeared itself to the journal by playing the great American situation comedy role of Daddy the Bungler. As for the post-mortem explanations of the debacle that have been offered by former Edsel executives, they are notable for their reflective tone, something like that of a knocked-out prizefighter opening his eyes to find an announcer's microphone pushed into his face. In fact, Crafty, like many a flattened pugilist, blames his own bad timing. He contends that if he had been able to thwart the apparently immutable mechanics and economics of Detroit and had somehow been able to bring out the Edsel in 1955, or even 1956, when the stock market and the medium-priced car market were riding high, the car would have done well and would still be doing well. That is to say, if he had seen the punch coming, he would have ducked. Crafty refuses to go along with a sizable group of laymen who tend to attribute the collapse to the company's decision to call the car the Edsel, instead of giving it a brisker, more singable name, reducible to a nickname other than Ed or Eddie, and not freighted with dynastic connotations. As far as he can see, Crafty still says the Edsel's name did not affect its fortunes one way or the other. Brown agrees with Crafty that bad timing was the chief mistake. I frankly feel that the styling of the automobile had very little, if anything, to do with its failure, he said later, and his frankness may pretty safely be left unchallenged. The Edsel program, like any other project planned for future markets, was based on the best information available at the time in which decisions were made. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. Doyle, with the born salesman's intensely personal feeling about his customers, talks like a man betrayed by a friend, the American public. It was a buyer's strike, he says. People weren't in the mood for the Edsel. Why not is a mystery to me. What they'd been buying for several years encouraged the industry to build exactly this kind of car. We gave it to them, and they wouldn't take it. Well, they shouldn't have acted like that. You can't just wake up somebody one day and say, that's enough. You've been running in the wrong direction. Anyway, why did they do it? Golly, how the industry worked and worked over the years. Getting rid of gear shifting, providing interior comfort, providing plus performance for use in emergencies, and now the public wants these little beetles. I don't get it. Wallace's Sputnik theory provides an answer to Doyle's question about why people weren't in the mood, and furthermore, it is sufficiently cosmic to befit a semi-brain truster. It also leaves Wallace free to defend the validity of his motivational research studies as of the time when they were conducted. I don't think we yet know the depths of the psychological effect that that first orbiting had on us all, he says. Somebody had beaten us to an important gain in technology, and immediately people started writing articles about how crummy Detroit products were, particularly the heavily ornamented and status-symbolic medium-priced cars. In 1958, when none of the small cars were out except the Rambler, Chevy almost ran away with the market because it had the simplest car. The American people had put themselves on a self-imposed austerity program. Not buying Edsels was their hair shirt. To any relics of the sink or swim 19th century days of American industry, it must seem strange that Wallace can afford to puff on his pipe and analyze the Holocaust so amiably. The obvious point of the Edsel story is the defeat of a giant motor company. But what is just as surprising is that the giant did not come apart, or even get seriously hurt in the fall, and neither did the majority of the people who went down with him. Owing largely to the success of four of its other cars, the Ford, the Thunderbird, and later on the small Falcon and Comet, and then the Mustang, the Ford Company, as an investment, survived gloriously. True, it had a bad time of it in 1958, when, partly because of the Edsel, net income per share of its stock fell from $5.40 to $2.12, dividends per share from $2.40 to $2, and the market price of its stock from a 1957 high of about $60 to a 1958 low of under $40. But all these losses were more than recouped in 1959, when net income per share was $8.24, dividends per share were $2.80, and the price of the stock reached a high of around $90. In 1960 and 1961, things went even better. So the 280,000 Ford stockholders listed on the books in 1957 had had little to complain about, unless they had sold at the height of the panic. On the other hand, 6,000 white-collar workers were squeezed out of their jobs as a result of the Mercury-Edsel-Lincoln consolidation, and the average number of Ford employees fell from 191,759 in 1957 to 142,076 the following year, climbing back to only 159,541 in 1959. And, of course, dealers who gave up profitable franchises and other makes and then went broke trying to sell Edsels weren't likely to be very cheerful about the experience. Under the terms of the consolidation of the Lincoln, Mercury, and Edsel divisions, most of the agencies for the three makes were consolidated too. In the consolidation, some Edsel dealers were squeezed out, and it can have been small comfort to those of them who went bankrupt to learn later that when the Ford company finally discontinued making the car, it agreed to pay those of their former colleagues who had weathered the crisis one half of the original cost of their Edsel signs, and was granting them substantial rebates on all Edsels in stock at the time of discontinuance. Still, automobile dealers, some of whom work on credit margins as slim as those of Miami hotel operators, occasionally go broke with even the most popular cars. And among those who earn their living in the rough-and-tumble world of automobile salesrooms, where Detroit is not always spoken of with affection, many will concede that the Ford Company, once it had found itself stuck with a lemon, did as much as it reasonably could to bolster dealers who had cast their lot with Edsel. A spokesman for the National Automobile Dealers Association has since stated, "So far as we know, the Edsel dealers were generally satisfied with the way they were treated." Foot, Cone, and Belding also ended up losing money on the Edsel account, since its advertising commissions did not entirely compensate for the extraordinary expense it had gone to of hiring 60 new people and opening up a posh office in Detroit. But its losses were hardly irreparable. The minute there were no more Edsels to advertise, it was hired to advertise Lincolns. And although that arrangement did not last very long, the firm has happily survived to sing the praises of such clients as General Foods, Lever Brothers, and Transworld Airways. A rather touching symbol of the loyalty that the agency's employees have for its former client is the fact that for several years after 1959, on every workday, its private parking lot in Chicago was still dotted with Edsels. These faithful drivers, incidentally, are not unique. If Edsel owners have not found the means to a dream fulfillment, and if some of them, for a while, had to put up with harrowing mechanical disorders, many of them, more than a decade later, cherish their cars as if they were Confederate bills. And on used car row, the Edsel is a high premium item, with few cars being offered. By and large, the former Edsel executives did not just land on their feet. They landed in clover. Certainly, no one can accuse the Ford Company of giving vent to its chagrin in the old-fashioned way, by vulgarly causing heads to roll. Craffey was assigned to assist Robert S. McNamara, at that time a Ford Divisional Vice President, and later, of course, Secretary of Defense, for a couple of months, and then he moved to a staff job in company headquarters, stayed there for about a year, and left to become a Vice President of the Raytheon Company of Waltham, Massachusetts, a leading electronics firm. In April 1960, he was made its president. In the middle 60s, he left to become a high-priced management consultant on the West Coast. Doyle, too, was offered a staff job with Ford. But after taking a trip abroad to think it over, he decided to retire. "It was a question of my relationship to my dealers," he explains. "I had assured them that the company was fully behind the Edsel for keeps, and I didn't feel that I was the fellow to tell them now that it wasn't." After his retirement, Doyle remained about as busy as ever, keeping an eye on various businesses in which he has set up various friends and relatives, and conducting a consulting business of his own in Detroit. About a month before Edsel's consolidation with Mercury and Lincoln, Warnock, the publicity man, left the division to become director of news services for the International Telephone and Telegraph Corporation in New York, a position he left in June 1960 to become vice president of communications counselors, the public relations arm of McCann Erickson. From there, he went back to Ford as Eastern Promotion Chief for Lincoln Mercury, a case of a head that had not rolled, but had instead been anointed. Brown, the embattled stylist, stayed on in Detroit for a while as chief stylist of Ford Commercial Vehicles, and then went with the Ford Motor Company Limited of England, where, again as chief stylist, he was assigned to direct the design of consoles, Anglias, trucks, and tractors. He insisted that this post didn't represent the Ford version of Siberia. "I found it to be a most satisfying experience, and one of the best steps I have ever taken in my career," he stated firmly in a letter from England. "We are building a styling office and a styling team second to none in Europe." Wallace, the semi-brain truster, was asked to continue semi-brain trusting for Ford, and since he still didn't like living in Detroit or near it, was permitted to move to New York and to spend only 2 days a week at headquarters. "They didn't seem to care anymore where I operated from," he says modestly. At the end of 1958, he left Ford, and he has since finally achieved his heart's desire, to become a full-time scholar and teacher. He set about getting a doctorate in sociology at Columbia, writing his thesis on social change in Westport, Connecticut, which he investigated by busily quizzing its inhabitants. Meanwhile, he taught a course on the dynamics of social behavior at the New School for Social Research in Greenwich Village. "I'm through with industry," he was heard to declare one day, with evident satisfaction, as he boarded a train for Westport, a bundle of questionnaires under his arm. Early in 1962, he became Dr. Wallace. The subsequent euphoria of these former Edsel men did not stem entirely from the fact of their economic survival. They appear to have been enriched spiritually. They are inclined to speak of their Edsel experience, except for those still with Ford, who are inclined to speak of it as little as possible, with the verve and garrulity of old comrades-in-arms, hashing over their most thrilling campaign. Doyle is perhaps the most passionate reminiscer in the group. "It was more fun than I've ever had before or since," he told a caller in 1960. "I suppose that's because I worked the hardest ever. We all did. It was a good crew. The people who came with Edsel knew they were taking a chance, and I like people who'll take chances. Yes, it was a wonderful experience, in spite of the unfortunate thing that happened. And we were on the right track, too. When I went to Europe, just before retiring, I saw how it is there. Nothing but compact cars. Yet they've still got traffic jams over there. They've still got parking problems. They've still got accidents. Just try getting in and out of those low taxicabs without hitting your head. Or try not to get clipped while you're walking around the Arc de Triomphe. This small car thing won't last forever. I can't see American drivers being satisfied for long with manual gear shifting and limited performance. The pendulum will swing back." Warnock, like many a public relations man before him, claims that his job gave him an ulcer, his second. "But I got over it," he says. "That great Edsel team, I just like to see what it could have done if it had had the right product at the right time. It could have made millions, that's what. The whole thing was 2 years out of my life that I'll never forget. It was history in the making. Doesn't it all tell you something about America in the 50s? High hopes and less than complete fulfillment of them?" Craffy, the boss of the great team, Monkey, is entirely prepared to testify that there is more to his former subordinate's talk than just the romantic vaporings of old soldiers. "It was a wonderful group to work with," he said not long ago. "They really put their hearts and guts into the job. I'm interested in a crew that's strongly motivated, and that one was. When things went bad, the Edsel boys could have cried about how they'd given up wonderful opportunities to come with us, but if anybody did, I never heard about it. I'm not surprised that they've mostly come out all right. In industry, you take a bump now and then, but you bounce back as long as you don't get defeated inside. I like to get together with somebody once in a while, Gail Warnock or one of the others, and go over the humorous incidents, the tragic incidents. Whether the nostalgia of the Edsel boys for the Edsel runs to the humorous or to the tragic, it is a thought-provoking phenomenon. Maybe it means merely that they miss the limelight they first basked in and later squirmed in. Or maybe it means that a time has come when, as in Elizabethan drama but seldom before in American business, failure can have a certain grandeur that success never knows. Chapter 3. The Federal Income Tax. 1. Beyond a doubt, many prosperous and ostensibly intelligent Americans have in recent years done things that, to a naive observer, might appear outlandish, if not actually lunatic. Men of inherited wealth, some of them given to the denunciation of government in all its forms and manifestations, have shown themselves to be passionately interested in the financing of state and municipal governments, and have contributed huge sums to this end. Weddings between persons with very high incomes and persons with not so high incomes have tended to take place most often near the end of December, and least often during January. Some exceptionally successful people, especially in the arts, have been abruptly and urgently instructed by their financial advisors to do no more gainful work under any circumstances for the rest of the current calendar year, and have followed this advice, even though it sometimes came as early as May or June. Actors and other people with high incomes from personal services have again and again become the proprietors of sand and gravel businesses, bowling alleys, and telephone answering services, doubtless adding a certain elan to the conduct of those humdrum establishments. Motion picture people, as if fulfilling a clockwork schedule of renunciation and reconciliation, have repeatedly abjured their native soil in favor of foreign countries for periods of 18 months, only to embrace it again in the 19th. Petroleum investors have peppered the earth of Texas with speculative oil wells, taking